This is Iconography, a podcast about the geography of icons, real and imagined. I'm Charles Gustine. This episode, Terry Pratchett's Discworld. For years and years, Terry Pratchett wasn't a famous author. He was just an author. And I'm guessing he wore whatever he felt like wearing. If it was cold enough, he wore a jacket. And coming as he did from a long line of follically challenged individuals, and encountering some follicle challenges of his own by his early 30s, he probably wore quite a few hats. Now, it didn't particularly matter what kind of hat. If it covered his head, that would do. When Pratchett sat for his first interview in 1985 with a 24-year-old freelancer, he wore an Argyle sweater, an anorak, and, covering his head, a flat cap, apparently, unaware that George R.R. Martin would be taking the flat cap in the Fantasy Writer's Hat Draft, thank you very much. You know what? No harm, no foul. Who on earth would know or care what hat this guy wore to a lunch interview at a Chinese restaurant? Honestly, Pratchett's publicist had been surprised that anyone would want to interview the author of The Color of Magic, a jokey fantasy parody set on a flat Discworld, and 2 years after it had been published. Terry Pratchett had been a published author for over a decade, over 2 decades if you count the short story he got published when he was 13, but he wasn't quitting his day job. Literally. It would be another 2 years and another few Discworld novels before Terry stopped working as the press officer for an electricity company and dedicated himself to writing full-time. The only reason people know anything about that first Terry Pratchett interview today, know what hat he wore, isn't because people were avidly reading about Terry Pratchett in Space Voyager magazine in 1985. The magazine folded a few issues later. It's because that lunch hour in London, Terry Pratchett, the interviewee, and Neil Gaiman, the interviewer, met. The oldest Terry Pratchett interview I can find on YouTube is from April 13th, 1995.
Please welcome the man whose imagination conjured up those spirits, Terry Pratchett.
In the 10 years that passed between Pratchett's first interview with Neil Gaiman and his interview on Pebble Mill in 1995, Pratchett had collaborated with Gaiman on one of the funniest novels of all time, and had written 17 novels that joined The Color of Magic in the Discworld canon.
For those who have lived in a cave in Vladivostok and haven't seen them on the bookshelves, because they're everywhere whenever I go in my bookshop, just sum up what the Discworld books are about.
How long have we got?
Not that long.
The Discworld is a flat world. It's a deliberately ridiculous fantasy world. And I put real people on it, and I dress them as wizards and witches, and they have adventures. But they have all the adventures out of fairy story, but because they are modern people, they think about them differently. I mean, that's about the best way I can think of describing it.
He's famous in 1995, famous enough that host Alan Titchmarsh is venturing that his viewers are oblivious if they haven't at least heard of Terry Pratchett and his Discworld. He's famous in the way that most authors are, as the name on a book cover, or in Terry's case, the name on a lot of book covers, on an entire bookshelf. But to some, he's already more than a name on a book cover. He has fans, fans who flock to book signings and who chat to each other on the Usenet group alt.fan.pratchett, where, in 1 week actually, on April 21st, 1995, it's going to be announced that a Discworld mini-convention is coming. Just a few people who love the books sharing an afternoon, dinner and drinks. Well, 2 days after that, the mini is dropped from the mini-convention. It turns out there's enough interest to sustain a full-blown, 3-day, ran-out-of-hotel-and-invite-Terry convention to be held in June 1996. Terry is going to wear a hat to the convention gala, and it's a hat that's probably becoming quite familiar to folks who've been to more than one of his signings. A wide-brimmed black number, as dark as the bow tie that sets off his cream-colored suit jacket. Back to Pebble Mill. For daytime TV, Terry opts for a cream-colored jacket as well, but without the black accents, aside from what little black remains in his eyebrows and his beard. No hat, He looks bright and cheery, and he gives bright and cheery answers on a pastel stage that shouts, "Bright and cheery." And it's not that Terry Pratchett wasn't bright or cheery. Most people who met him thought him quite jolly, much to Neil Gaiman's chagrin. Some years ago, I ran into someone who had once been Terry's handler at a convention in Texas. His eyes misted over at the memory of getting Terry from his panel to the book dealer's room and back. "What a jolly old elf Sir Terry is," he said. And I thought, no, he's not. Terry Pratchett is not a jolly old elf at all. Not even close. He's so much more than that. Terry Pratchett was not dark or moody, but he was sharp, cheeky, self-effacing, and averse to BS, sometimes aggressively so. Once when Gaiman had tried to calm his friend down, Pratchett had snapped, "Do not underestimate this anger. This anger was the engine that powered Good Omens." In 1995, Pratchett hadn't quite found the costume that announced all these things. He would. If you're looking at an image of Terry Pratchett, you can generally measure how far along the road he is to iconhood by how much black he's wearing. By the late aughts, 36 Discworld novels in and counting, when Pratchett was a fixture not just on British bookshelves, but also on British television screens, presenting documentary series about living with his rare form of Alzheimer's.
"I've decided I'm not going to go down without a fight." I'm giving $1 million to the Alzheimer's Research Trust to help find a cure."
Advocating for the right to choose when to die.
"I'm talking about assisted dying, which is currently not legal in this country."
Getting knighted, and of course, publicizing new novels even when he could no longer type them himself. By the time he became ubiquitous, he had settled on a look so consistent you could put it in a museum and say, "See? Terry Pratchett." In fact, someone has built a museum exhibit around that look. I'm at the His World exhibition in Salisbury, standing in front of a mannequin dressed in what one might call Pratchett chic. I don't really have to describe what this ensemble looks like. I could just tell you to Google Terry Pratchett and good luck finding a picture where he's not wearing it. But I want to stay in front of this mannequin for just a minute longer. Black cane with a silver head. Literally a head. The head of his most famous character, Death. Black satchel bag, black t-shirt, black leather jacket, and, crowning it all, the pièce de résistance, the black Louisiana fedora. The cane and fedora, joining his trademark round spectacles and white beard, would put one in mind of Jurassic Park founder John Hammond, a kindly old dreamer with a twinkle in his eye.
"It's a flea circus. They all move, motorized, of course, but people would say they could see the fleas. Oh, I can see the fleas, Mummy, can't you see the fleas? Clown fleas and high wire fleas and fleas on parade."
But this was John Hammond taking fashion tips from Ian Malcolm. Be old-fashioned, fine, but spice it up with some darkness, danger, and leather. None of these sartorial choices were unconscious choices, mind. Pratchett was a man who knew the power of a statement piece and had a lot of thoughts about hats. In 2002, The Guardian mused that if you were to pass the best-selling British author of the 1990s in the street, particularly without his famous black hat, the chances are that you wouldn't look twice.
"The hat is a Zen disguise," he says. "If I take it off, I'm just another bald-headed, bearded man."
But the label below the mannequin in the Salisbury Museum strikes a more somber, less jocular tone.
"I don't become a real person with the hat on. I become an unreal person with the hat on. It's tough under there. Sometimes the hat has to come off. The hat is an anti-disguise."
In his Discworld books, Pratchett's witches and wizards go out of their way to look the part, because looking the part is half the job. If someone saw your pointy hat, They were convinced you were powerful, that you knew something they didn't, and that you could do something bad to them if you wanted to. It's what Pratchett's witch, Granny Weatherwax, called headology. One time, Granny Weatherwax lost her hat.
Hats were important, Pratchett interjects. They weren't just clothing. Hats defined the head. They defined who you were. Every trade, every craft has its hat. That's why kings had hats. Take the crown off a king, and all you had was someone good at having a weak chin and waving at people. Hats had power. Hats were important. But so were people.
In that spirit, let's look away from the hat and focus on my favorite part of this mannequin's ensemble, the t-shirt Terry would sometimes wear to signings and events. Simple black shirt, white letters. Top line, largest print.
Tolkien is dead.
Next line, large letters.
J.K. Rowling said no.
Third line, smaller letters.
Philip Pullman couldn't make it.
Last line, tiny letters.
Hi, I'm Terry Pratchett.
I'd like to point out, for the record, that I did not bring up J.R.R. Tolkien. He did. But as long as we're on the subject, Pratchett always credited the 25 hours he spent inhaling The Lord of the Rings at 13 as a major life-changing moment.
That damn book was a half-brick in the path of the bicycle of my life. I started reading fantasy books at the kind of speed you can only manage in your early teens. I panted for the stuff.
At 19, he wrote to Tolkien about how much the novella Smith of Wootton Manor had moved him.
An odd feeling of grief overcame me as I read it.
Which seemingly impressed Tolkien, because he wrote back to say he'd never received fan mail about Smith of Wootton Manor before, and, well, he felt very much the same way about it. Pratchett signed off his letter, saying he eagerly looked forward to the Silmarillion. And yet, once he became a known author in his own right, Terry Pratchett largely bristled at comparisons to Tolkien. They got old.
Comparisons are odious, so do you get upset if people say, are you a bit like Tolkien, then, or that kind of writer? Is that fair or not?
He's more dead than I am.
Yeah. What about his characters?
And I'm funnier than him.
You're funnier than, funnier than he's...
I think I can see why he wanted to distance himself from Tolkien. Terry Pratchett wrote about dragons and wizards, but he didn't just want to be the next Dragons and Wizards guy. He was a satirist. He crafted jokes and gags. He dabbled in noir. If you just compared him to Tolkien and called it a day, you lost all that. Pratchett always proudly embraced being a fantasy writer. But he also railed against the ways being a fantasy writer boxed you in and kept you from being any other type of writer.
Recent Discworld novels have spun on such concerns as the nature of belief, politics, and even journalistic freedom. But put in one lousy dragon, and they call you a fantasy writer.
That's Pratchett as he accepted his first major literary award in 2001, a Carnegie Medal for the first Discworld book targeted at a younger audience, The Amazing Maurice and His Educated Rodents. He used the long-overdue platform to advocate for his vision of fantasy.
Far more beguiling to me than the idea that evil can be destroyed by throwing a piece of expensive costume jewelry into a volcano is the possibility that peace between nations can be maintained by careful diplomacy. Fantasy isn't just about wizards and silly wands. It's about seeing the world from new directions.
After that speech, it became something of a sport, nay, a national pastime, among journalists to get Pratchett going on the subject of fantasy's ghettoization as a genre, and on the public's seeming inability to take more than one fantasy author seriously at a time. Remember here what Neil Gaiman told us earlier. He wasn't a jolly old elf. Discworld was built on rage.
That anger, it seems to me, is about Terry's underlying sense of what is fair and what is not.
And Pratchett did see this arm's-length treatment of fantasy as patently unfair, and he wasn't afraid to be angry about it. He always demurred, saying he'd much rather be a bestseller than a part of the literary establishment, but his demurrals never let perceived snobs off the hook. He once mused, as he pointed to the Dayglow cover of his 26th Discworld novel, The Thief of Time,
"A friend of mine said it would be impossible for you to win the Booker. All the stars would go out. The world is not constructed for that to happen, for a man who writes books with covers that look like that, and who wears a leather jacket and says he writes fantasy, and who believes he owes a debt to the science fiction fantasy genre which he grew up out of, refuses to say he writes magical realism, which is like a polite way of saying you write fantasy and is more acceptable to certain people."
Now, considering that this was a pet peeve of Pratchett's, imagine what his face must have looked like when he read the 2005 J.K. Rowling profile, where she told Time magazine that she doesn't especially like fantasy novels, never having read through The Lord of the Rings or the Narnia books, and she hadn't realized her first Potter novel was fantasy until after it was finished. She'd ultimately decided she was subverting fantasy, not writing it. And whether she liked fantasy or not, she apparently had saved it, according to Time, moving it at last past an idealized, romanticized, pseudo-feudal world where knights and ladies Morris danced to greensleeves. Now, Terry Pratchett, cheeky t-shirt aside, had largely gone out of his way in years past to be diplomatic about Rowling's success, telling a Sydney Morning Herald interviewer in 2004,
"I'm painfully aware that not you, but plenty of people would love Pratchett slams Rowling as a headline."
Well, after Rowling said she didn't consider herself a fantasy writer, there were a lot of Pratchett slams Rowling headlines.
"I would have thought that the wizards, witches, trolls, unicorns, hidden worlds, jumping chocolate frogs, owl mail, magic food, ghosts, broomsticks, and spells would have given her a clue. Ever since The Lord of the Rings revitalized the genre, writers have played with it, reinvented it, subverted it, and bent it to their times. It has also contained some of the very best, most accessible writing for children by writers who seldom get the acknowledgement they deserve."
Pratchett became shorthand for exactly that sort of writer, for people looking to dismiss the Harry Potter phenomena as vapid. In 2003, novelist A.S. Byatt wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, "Harry Potter and the Childish Adult."
"This Rowling's magic world has no place for the numinous. It is written for people whose imaginative lives are confined to TV cartoons, and the exaggerated, more exciting, not threatening, mirror worlds of soaps, reality TV, and celebrity gossip. Miss Rowling, I think, speaks to an adult generation that hasn't known and doesn't care about mystery. They are inhabitants of urban jungles, not of the real wild. They don't have the skills to tell ersatz magic from the real thing, for as children they daily invested the ersatz with what imagination they had."
I have to confess that my reaction to this piece is multifaceted. I'm not sure whether I don't get the argument because it's a bad argument that seems to have no relationship to the texts, or because it's such a smart argument that I can't get it. Or won't get it because I'm blinkered by my nostalgic attachment to J.K. Rowling. Also, can I admit that a small part of me is relieved reading this decrial of the childish adult who made Harry Potter a bestseller? That, in 2003, I was a childish child? Anyway, Byatt does something at the end of her piece that I know I don't like. For sure.
"In the days before dumbing down in cultural studies, no one reviewed Enid Blyton or Georgette Heyer, as they do not now review the great Terry Pratchett, whose wit is metaphysical, who creates an energetic and lively secondary world, who has a multifarious genius for strong parody as opposed to derivative manipulation of past motifs, who deals with death with startling originality, who writes amazing sentences."
Byatt uses Terry Pratchett's genius to say, why her? Why does this pastiche artist get feted by the literary establishment while Terry Pratchett is ignored? If not him, then certainly not her. To which I say, why not both? Google J.K. Rowling, Terry Pratchett, or better yet, rummage around some forums circa 2001 to 2005, and you'll see that when J.K. Rowling's and Terry Pratchett's names end up in the same sentence, that sentence is pretty much never, hey, have you heard of these two equally wonderful fantasy authors whom I both adore? But that's what I'll say. That's my sentence. There's room in this world to take both of them seriously, and as part of that serious consideration, to add that maybe they don't share that much in common, except, from my perspective, this. Their books are the only ones that I find so addictive that I can't put them down, so that I gobble them all up in one night and say, all right, next one. Ultimately, I think Rowling and Pratchett were doing very different things, even if they were using a similar palette of wizards and trolls. Rowling nestled the unfamiliar within a very familiar world. Many of you are still probably waiting for your owl that says you're enrolled at Hogwarts. I know I am. So immersively did she weave the extraordinary into the mundane. Pratchett did the opposite. He nestled the familiar within a deeply unfamiliar world. His characters lived on a flat world set upon four elephants that rode the great turtle Atween through the cosmos, and, yeah, Death would stop by for a chat and tea before taking them off through the dark desert. But the denizens of the disc were, on the whole, pretty mundane.
We need a cauldron, and a magic sword, and an octogram, and spices, and all sorts of stuff.
You don't need none of that. You need technology. You just use whatever you've got.
We conjure and abjure thee by means of this long and terrible wooden spoon.
See how we scatter. Rather old washing soda and extremely hard soap flakes in thy honor.
I love both approaches. I'll tell you what, though. One is probably a lot easier to make an iconography episode about. When it comes to thinking about the geography of icons, I think I went with hard mode, choosing the flat world on the turtle. When I launched Iconography 18 episodes ago, I started out wondering the following. How do we understand the places we visit, and even the places we've never been? Well, as a shorthand, we tend to use agreed-upon touchstones. Places, like monuments and gravesites. People, like statesmen and singers. Objects, like food and fashion. And, of course, dreams. Dreamed-up people.
Mr. Potter.
And dreamed-up places.
Platform 9 3/4.
And dreamed-up things.
Bertie bought Seppi flavor beans.
As you can tell from my subtle use of clips, I always figured that when I finally waltzed into full-on dreamland and tried to tie it into how those dreams shape our world, I'd be talking about Harry Potter. I am a Harry Potter kid from a Harry Potter generation. I live in London, and I still often think of the city in terms Rowling laid out for me 20 years ago, when the only Britain I had was hers. A Harry Potter episode of Iconography would be easy. He's everywhere. He wills himself onto the topography. The snack trolley on the train will never not bring to mind the Hogwarts Express. And King's Cross knows this. They know which side their bread is buttered on, and it's the side with Ravenclaw scarves and wands. In comparison, it's difficult to play my typical game with Discworld. Pratchett is a consummate British writer, but it's tough at first glance to map onto our world a fantasy world where there is no London or England, or to be more precise, where those places exist, but only in a magicless round world that's kept in a glass sphere at Unseen University. But what can I do? This month, I went to a book club, and the book was a Discworld novel, my first Discworld novel, and I was smitten. I went 28 apparently forlorn years without reading any Pratchett outside of Good Omens, and just like that, the Wee Free Men converted me. Above all else, I'm taken with his prose. Pratchett is a man for whom silence could never just be silence. Silence has dimensions. In The We Free Men, Pratchett writes,
"There was silence, embroidered with the breathing of her sisters. But in a way Tiffany couldn't quite describe, it was the silence of people trying hard not to make any noise."
Embroidered. One thing I do agree with A.S. Byatt on, maybe the only thing, is that Terry Pratchett did write amazing sentences. Actually, that doesn't quite do it. Terry Pratchett wrote amazing paragraphs. There's nothing more magical than getting to the end of a Terry Pratchett paragraph and waiting for the kicker he'll deliver. When I got to this paragraph on page 6 of The We Free Men, it was all over. I was in love.
"This is Tiffany walking back home. Start with the boots. They are big and heavy boots, much repaired by her father, and they belonged to various sisters before her. She wore several pairs of socks to keep them on. They are big. Tiffany sometimes feels she is nothing more than a way of moving boots around."
With that last sentence, I was an acolyte, a worshipper. Now, as you might guess, I'm still in the middle of an ongoing journey. I'm not a machine. I'm only a few novels in, my focus staying with the witch-centric Discworld novels, the early ones featuring steely Granny Weatherwax, and the later ones where Granny takes young Tiffany Aching, a shepherd's daughter from the Chalk, under her wing. No matter. Regardless of how far I got, I knew two things reading those first few pages of The We Free Men. One, that I would be doing my next episode on Terry Pratchett come hell or high water. And two, that I had no idea how I was going to do that. Which is how I ended up in Salisbury. Why Salisbury, I wondered. What anchored Discworld to this place? It seemed an unlikely location for an exhibit on Terry Pratchett. Or at least it would for someone who still has a relatively poor grasp of English towns and their locations. The centerpiece of the exhibition, even more alluring than the mannequin in Terry's clothes, is the full reconstruction of Terry's office, with his old desk topped with 6 screens. Every once in a while, an invisible Terry Pratchett types a few paragraphs about Sam Vimes, or plays Doom, while emails from Neil Gaiman pop up. And you can feel everyone in the room inhale. It almost feels like he's there. This setup did not have far to travel. As it turns out, Pratchett was a local. For 22 years, he lived in a manorette in Broadchalk, 8 miles outside Salisbury. The people of Salisbury started a successful petition after Sir Terry's death, and now they're set to erect a 7-foot-tall statue of the author in the city. Neil Gaiman.
He would have said something a bit sarcastic about it, and have been secretly very pleased.
Finally, visiting Salisbury, visiting the His World exhibition at the Salisbury Museum, I had my anchor. Suddenly, I knew where the Chalk was. I knew where Tiffany Aching grew up. Reading the books, I had assumed that because Tiffany meets a roving band of Pixies with exaggerated Scottish brogues, Pratchett was riffing on Northern England, close to the Scottish border. But the Chalk was, in fact, his love letter to the south of England, where he grew up and spent his life, on the southern English Chalk formation that stretches from Dover to Salisbury and beyond. At the exhibition, next to a beautiful Paul Kidby depiction of Discworld's Chalk, the label reads,
"There was a chalk pit on the way to school when I was a little kid. It was my introduction to geology. This crumbly white rock with the fossils in it was the floor of an old sea. There is a lot of my past in some of the descriptions in the books. A lot of the places in the books I could walk to right now."
Tiffany Aching was dreamed up in a shepherding hut on Terry's property, below a Paul Kidby drawing of Tiffany.
"A lot of Tiffany's story is set in Chalk Country, the countryside where I lived. It's a Discworld book, but a lot of the feeling of the Chocklands and some of its mythology and folklore is built into it.
It's not that it hadn't occurred to me previously that the real world had seeped into Discworld. Most of Pratchett's Discworld regions are thinly veiled approximations of real places. In Weird Sisters, a dwarf named Hwell writes brilliant plays, and he builds a round open-air theater called The Disc on the sketchier Morpork banks of the grand capital city of Ankh Morpork. And in Witches Abroad, the coven has to stop a marriage in faraway Genua, which is a gleaming city surrounded by swamp where visitors consume massive amounts of banana daiquiris during the raucous Fat Lunchtime Festival.
There were, it seemed to Nanny Hogg, two cities in Genua. There was the white one, all new houses and blue-roofed palaces. And around it, and even under it, was the old one. The new one might not like the presence of the old one, but it couldn't quite ever do without it. Someone, somewhere, has to do the cooking.
This isn't technically about New Orleans. It's about Genua. But, as Pratchett describes the versatility of the poor Genuans, who can make life-changing dishes out of the creatures they fish out of the swamp muck, alligator, lobster, crawfish, it occurs to you that it's not about New Orleans either. But because it's not specifically about New Orleans, it can also be about any place where that stratification exists. The power of fantasy. It wasn't that Pratchett couldn't write about the Salisbury Plain or New Orleans. It's just, why would he, when he could write about the Chalk and Genua? In 1985, back when there was still only one Discworld novel out there in the world, and a bunch more in his head, Terry Pratchett gave a talk on gender bias in fantasy called Why Gandalf Never Married.
The consensus fantasy universe is full of clichés, almost by definition. Elves are tall and fair and use bows. Dwarves are small and dark and vote labor. While I was plundering the fantasy world for the next cliché to pull a few laughs from, I found one which was so deeply ingrained that you hardly notice it is there at all. In fact, it struck me so vividly that I actually began to look at it seriously. That's the generally very clear division between magic done by women and magic done by men.
It's a bit of a clumsy talk, hilarious when it's about the fantasy genre in general, a bit tedious when it dives into stuff about druidical history and practicing witches as a means of pointing out that high magic must seemingly always steer clear of women. But it is clear that that underlying sense of what is fair and what is not was getting that Pratchett anger roiling. 2 years after the talk, in 1987, that anger gave us his first novel about the witches of Discworld, Equal Rights, with rights spelled R-I-T-E-S, a pun he also used at the end of the Gandalf talk. In Equal Rights, fate decides that young Escarina Smith from the small mountain village of Badass will be the Disc's first female wizard. It's not a choice. It was chosen for her when she was born. And the world around her considers that and goes, no. You are a young lady. You shall choose to be a witch. The local witch, Granny Weatherwax, tries to convince Esk that witchcraft is more her speed. Why would she want to be a silly, doddering wizard studying from books all day anyway? And the wizards at Unseen University in Ankh Morpork dismiss Esk out of hand. The lore says wizards are men. And that's how it has always been.
Why was it that when she heard Granny ramble on about witchcraft, she longed for the cutting magic of wizardry? But whenever she heard Treacle speak in his high-pitched voice, she would fight to the death for witchcraft. She'd do both, or none at all. And the more they intended to stop her, the more she wanted it. She'd be a witch and a wizard, too. And she would show them.
This, right here, is the moment, 2.5 novels into writing about Discworld, that Pratchett stops making fun of something and starts really making something. Discworld started as a container for some swords and sorcery pastiche.
I was doing it for the fun, to seriously parody a lot of bad fantasy, and indeed some good fantasy, which nevertheless is worth parodying. Since that time, I've discovered the joy of plot.
Neil Gaiman, an honest friend to the very end, agrees.
Part of the problem with Terry's fiction is a lot of people wind up starting there. So this is The Colour of Magic. It's a romp, and it's a terrible place to start. And it's a collection of jokes, and in The Colour of Magic, they aren't even very good jokes. The Terry Pratchett of fine and beautiful plots built like Swiss watches was a long way from turning up. But he's building something.
What's remarkable is that when Pratchett moved past satirizing Conan the Barbarian and started considering equal rights for women and organized religion and the film industry in his fiction, he stuck with this insane Discworld where people could do magic. And why not? Anything could happen on Discworld. And it's because anything could happen that it's so powerful when nothing does. Witches in Discworld have immense power, but unlike wizards, they don't go around showing it off. The mark of a good witch has nothing to do with wands or wishes upon stars. It comes from her ability to think and to step back from those thoughts and have second thoughts about where those first thoughts came from. A truly gifted witch can have third thoughts. With all those layers of knowing, a witch almost never has to use magic on people because if she reads them right, if she uses headology, she can make them think she already is using magic. In the second Tiffany Aching book, A Hatful of Sky, Tiffany, who's a bit of a know-it-all, she grows really frustrated with Granny Weatherwax because Granny never tells the truth. She tells people who have their privy too close to their well that goblins, not microbes, are making their children sick. She tells a man with chest pains that he needs to walk to a waterfall every day for a month and throw 3 pebbles to the water spirits.
That's not doctoring,
she pouts.
No, but he thinks it is. A 5-mile walk in the fresh air every day for a month will see him right as rain. You have to tell people a story they can understand. A story gets things done.
My wife is a nurse. Working in London has meant switching from day shifts to night shifts on a regular basis. It's meant adjusting to another nation's way of doing healthcare, which has been a rough adjustment at times. She's currently applying for a master's in public health. This is her life, and as such, I hear about it every day. And I know that she's a superhero, and I know that the very fact that I can spend weeks researching and writing about Terry Pratchett means that I never get to complain about work around her. But I also know that I only have the faintest idea what things are really like for her. She walks across the street to work, and from my perspective, for 12 hours, she may as well be manning a space shuttle to Mars. You have to tell people a story they can understand. A story gets things done. In A Hatful of Sky, Tiffany, frustrated, asks her teacher, Miss Lovell, about a very old, bedridden man.
Couldn't you help him by magic? I see to it that he's in no pain, yes, said Miss Lovell. But that's just herbs. It's still magic. Knowing things is magical if other people don't know them. Yes, but you know what I mean, said Tiffany, who felt she was losing this argument. Oh, you mean make him young again? Said Miss Lovell. Fill his house with gold? That's not what witches do. We see to it that lonely old men get a cooked dinner and cut their toenails, said Tiffany just a little sarcastically. Well, yes, said Miss Lovell. We do what can be done.
Later, Tiffany asks Granny Weatherwax why she was set up with Miss Lovell, who other witches don't respect very much.
I knew. I'd been told a story I could understand. You want to talk about the geography of icons, real and imagined? Well, thanks to Terry Pratchett, I can look out at the hospital across the street, and I can say, I know why my wife is a good nurse.
Because she likes people. She cares about them. Even the stupid, mean, dribbling ones, the mothers with the runny babies and nuisance, the feckless and the silly and the fools who treat her like some kind of servant. Now that's what I call magic. Seeing all that, dealing with all that, and still going on. It's sitting up all night with some poor old man who's leaving the world, taking away such pain as you can, comforting their terror, seeing them safely on their way. We all do that in our own way, and she does it the better in me if I was to put my hand on my heart. That is the root and heart and soul and center of witchcraft, that is. The soul and center. Mistress Weatherwax smacked her fist into her hand, hammering out her words. The soul and center.
Thanks for listening to Iconography. You can reach out to me on Twitter with your memories of Terry Pratchett at Charles Gustine, CharlesGustine. Or you can leave a comment on the Iconography Facebook page, facebook.com/iconographypodcast. I'd love to hear what your favorite Pratchett books are, since I still have a lot to get to. If you enjoyed the podcast, please share it with your friends and help to spread the word by leaving a rating and review on iTunes. Special thanks to the Salisbury Museum for putting together such a wonderful exhibition. Our round world can feel pretty mundane, but it felt like some magic had seeped in from Discworld while I was there. The His World exhibition will run until January 13th, and I would highly recommend it if you can make it to Salisbury. Also, thank you to my wife. She didn't do any voices on this episode or anything like that, but it wouldn't have been possible without her.